Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and among the norms that Trump and company have suspended are what people on your team can get away with. And there are so many in the news right now. Kellyanne Conway mixing government and campaign work. A government agency just yesterday said she should be fired. Do you think the White House cares? Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao is helping to get funding for Kentucky, represented by her husband, Mitch McConnell. Amy Schwa, infamous for her book about being a tiger mom, praising Brett Kavanaugh, and now her daughter got a clerkship with guess who at the Supreme Court. And of course, Trump saying this week he would accept dirt on a political opponent again from a foreign government. Lindsey Graham, Mitt Romney, and Kevin McCarthy among the Republican congressional leaders taking issue with that. For Nancy Pelosi, it's more pressure to begin an impeachment.
It's a very sad thing. Very sad thing that he does not know right from wrong. I believe that he has been involved in a criminal cover-up. I've said that before, and our investigation is demonstrating that. The Mueller report showed obstruction of justice in at least 10, perhaps 11 places. But for the president to be so cavalier, to disregard, to be indifferent to law and any sense of ethics about who we are as a country, to say he would invite foreign intervention further.
House Speaker Pelosi yesterday, and with us now, Dahlia Lithwick, who writes about legal affairs for Slate and hosts their Amicus podcast. She has an article this week about sort of the new nepotism in the Trump administration. And she's also writing about 2020 candidate Elizabeth Warren. So we'll combine those things. Hey, Dahlia, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Can I start with the Kellyanne Conway story? I think this got a little buried with other things going on yesterday, like we might go to war with Iran. She's accused of violating the Hatch Act, and there's this office called the Office of Special Counsel, which is not Robert Mueller's office. It's an entirely different thing that says she should be fired. Can you explain the Hatch Act to our listeners?
Yeah, the Hatch Act is essentially, you know, it's almost 100 years old, and it was an attempt to depoliticize politics, which is its own irony. And it essentially hived off certain government officials who are not supposed to use their government perch in order to influence political races. And obviously that's murky, and there's sort of two different sorts of categories. But the idea essentially is you don't use your public office to get somebody elected or to disfavor somebody. And it's long been, you know, in favor, out of favor. Everybody quibbles with it. But in general, it's a norm that folks accept. And Conway's a funny case because she has gone out of her way to deride Joe Biden, to deride, you know, she goes on the shows and she talks smack about Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. And she's been cautioned time and time and time again that she is, you know, often doing this from inside the White House or explicitly in her posture as a White House advisor. And they keep cautioning her to stop. And she only a few weeks ago sort of said, oh, blah, 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 you know, let them come and get me and put me in jail. And so I think it's really emblematic of this thing you're describing, which is, look, it's in some sense unenforceable. The president himself would have to remove her, and he's not going to. But it's a norm that people at least pretended to respect and to adhere to. And that's completely blown up now.
How is that different qualitatively or legally from when any Democrat might go on TV, let's say, and knock Trump and, you know, say that he shouldn't be reelected next year or anything like that?
I think that it has to do with her position in the White House in this instance. So I think that that's the difference. And I think the article I read, there was a great piece this morning on NBC.com by Steve Vladek, who's a national security writer. And he says in his reading of it, it would actually even be fine if she brought the TV cameras into her home and talked as a private citizen and, you know, knocked Elizabeth Warren. The problem is doing it from not the office itself and using, you know, the words counselor to the president. So I think that's the distinction. And I think, again, it was always something that is only marginally respected, but by and large, the ethics lawyers are saying this is the sort of thing that if you got a warning saying, please don't use your position to go on Fox and deride candidates and you keep doing it, I think that's where it becomes clearer cut.
Can you explain to our listeners the Elaine Chao, Mitch McConnell story? This has been in the news this week, but it's not been a top line story in most places, but it sure looks like nepotism when you read the basic details.
Yeah, this was a piece that Politico reported out in some depth at the beginning of the week. And essentially what they said is that she had been using her office at the Department of Transportation, and she'd been directing both workers and funding to help Mitch McConnell to benefit him because he holds office in Kentucky. And so there was literally, it sounds like, a pipeline between the majority leader's office and hers in order to divert all sorts of projects and approvals and funding to Kentucky to benefit him. And this is another really interesting example of a story where when Politico sort of digs into what's happening, what they note at the upfront is they didn't even try to hide this. So the outrage isn't that this happens. I think so many of these stories are things that probably happen at some level in every administration. You know, people use their connections and they take someone from their staff and shuttle them to another staff, and now they have a pipeline. This happens, but people generally, I think, Brian, try to respect the niceties of looking like they're adhering to the ethics laws, making the disclosures, trying to hide the worst of it. Mm-hmm. And what Politico came up with is they didn't even pretend to adhere to the rules.
So this actually reminds me of Trump saying the other day that, yeah, he would take dirt on a political opponent again from Russia or whoever, because he's not even, you know, standing on a pretense of following norms or what even might be the law. And beyond that, putting national security at risk by potentially making him or people in his administration compromised by a foreign country, he just says, yeah, I'm going to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also a really good, we keep asking ourselves these frogs in a pot questions, right? At what point is the lawlessness, like, not just recreational grifting? At what point is it a national security crisis? And I think you just identified the line, right? At some point, we can all live with the fact that Mitch McConnell gets pet projects approved in his district so he can run for re-election. That, again, that kind of pork, it's gross. We've tried to legislate against it, but nobody's going to be dead because of it. But I think the real concern is that when you start saying that, you know, what I want is for Russians and the Chinese, and I think Trump name-checked the Norwegians,
He's so
involved.
Funny the way he brings, it's funny, not funny, the way he brings up Norway, right? He was reputed to have said that in that immigration meeting where he said he doesn't want people from all those S-hole black countries coming to the United States. He said, why can't we have more immigrants from Norway? So he brought it up again in this context. This one was on Mike, where he used that as the example. Never mind that it's really coming from Russia and China, primarily in places like that. So he says, if someone from Norway gives you information, you're not going to listen to it?
It's a tick that he has, and I don't understand what it signifies to him. I guess we should be really clear that the New York Times has now reported that he's walked this too back this morning. He just said in an interview that, oh, by all means, of course, if somebody approached me with Oppo research from a foreign country, I would run directly to the FBI. And of course, he only walks things back when people like Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell and his real allies in the Senate start to get alarmed. But I think that we should take very seriously the fact that in his head, the law is what he thinks it is at the moment he's saying it. And that, too, is a little worrisome. It doesn't do us a tremendous amount of good to hear that after people squawk, he said, oh, of course I would take this directly to the FBI, because he's been trying to delegitimize the FBI since the day he took office.
On the Mitch McConnell, Elaine Chao thing, it has a direct impact potentially on our region here in New York and New Jersey, because if we assume that infrastructure funding is finite and they're carving up a pie, if there's, you know, a not even secret favoritism for Kentucky because the transportation secretary happens to be married to the Senate Majority Leader who's from Kentucky, that takes money away from something that we feel around here is desperately needed, like the Gateway Tunnel, which was going to go forward until Trump stopped the funding for it. I know that's one of the things that we're going to talk to on Monday to Congresswoman from New Jersey, Mikey Sherrill, about. But it has consequences other than tisk tisk.
Of course it does, and I think it's probably worth noting that when they were asked for comments, the Department of Transportation said, oh, it was only a handful of projects, they only approved a few, but of course that isn't the point. It isn't the number of projects, the raw number of projects. It's whether, as you say, they're carving the pie up fairly, and whether the first person at the trough every single time is the secretary's husband. So you're completely right to say these are zero-sum decisions. And again, I guess I would just circle back to the initial point, which is, look, a lot of this happens all the time. And we know that people grease the skids for one another, and access and money and, you know, corruption. I mean, this is not something that was invented in 2016. There's always been pork. It's the complete contempt for the idea that it's bothersome. That's what worries me.
My guest is Slate legal affairs writer and host of their Amicus podcast, Dahlia Lithwick. Her piece this week is about the particular kinds of nepotism in the Trump administration. She also wrote the other day about Elizabeth Warren, both being a hawk on this and rising in the polls and being a new hope for a woman president. And we can take some phone calls for Dahlia at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. How about Alan in Brooklyn? You're on WNYC on a bus. Alan, you're on a bus?
I'm on a bus, yes, but I hope it's not too noisy.
We can hear you.
I was concerned that by inviting foreign powers to provide information that would be useful to his campaign, that information can include information of favors they've done him in kind, which could include violent acts against Trump's opposition in this country. Think of what the Saudis did to Khashoggi in Turkey, or what the Russians did to former agents in England, poisoning or murdering people. So this invitation to, quote, get information can be an invitation to get information about prior criminal acts of violence against Trump's opponents that would help him, but would be totally criminal and expose him to prosecution if he did it, or if his own campaign did it here. It reminds me of the rendition that happened for unlawful torture during the Iraqi war.
Alan, I love the fact that you called us from a bus. We know that people listen to the radio on their commutes. This is not usually what people think of, riding on a city bus, listening to live radio, and calling in. So put your phone on speaker so everyone can hear Dahlia's answer. I'm kidding. But Dahlia, he raises obviously a serious concern.
No, I mean, all of his concerns are serious. And I am really, first of all, I love that we were also just talking about infrastructure and that Alan's on a bus.
There
That's
you go.
Also terrific. But I think that it is absolutely unbelievably worrisome if you agree that, all of the national security agencies that believe that, Russians interfered with the 2016 election, that is not disputed. All of those same agencies agreed that the Saudis had, been responsible for the death of Khashoggi. These are all things that our national security apparatus agrees on. This is something that Robert Mueller found in his report. These are not things that are in dispute. And so then when you have Donald Trump not only saying none of those things actually happened, not only does it sort of destabilize just basic ideas of truth and truth seeking, but it really delegitimizes people who are out there, you know, on the front lines trying to protect the country. Fred Kaplan has a really good piece up today in Slate just talking about how dangerous it is when you're, quote, investigating the investigators, which is what Bill Barr is doing. What you're actually doing is putting American intelligence personnel in harm's way. And so the idea that you're going to be simultaneously, you know, as Alan just suggested, sort of inviting this kind of interference, but also really profoundly endangering people who are working to gather intelligence out in the field. It's so demoralizing to be a person who has been a career, Justice Department official, a career FBI official, CIA, and to hear the president essentially saying, we want more people to come in and infiltrate our systems, and we want to investigate people who find things that we don't like. It is toxic in about seven different ways. And I really do think, even if you're sort of numb and bored by all the like truthful, you know, the distortions of truth, this kind of stuff is deeply damaging to national security. It's next level.
Alan, thank you for raising all that. And don't forget to exit through the rear. Dahlia, where does Elizabeth Warren start to enter any of this, who you wrote about this week? I know she's been vocal about Freddie Mac loans, things like that. One of the big political stories this week is actually a poll in California, a 2020 presidential race primary poll that shows Elizabeth Warren has moved into second place, which means she's passed Bernie Sanders. I think it's the first time that any candidate has done that in any major statewide poll anywhere. It also means she's ahead of Kamala Harris, who should be a favorite daughter, theoretically, in California. This is consistent with the recent upward trajectory for Warren. I should say, really, the long-term, very slow but steady upward trajectory. But this is news if she's now polling second in huge California. So where does she enter the larger narrative for you on the issues?
Well, you know, when I went out and watched her on the trail, she was a distant fourth and fifth. So she's really, even in the sort of 2-3 weeks since I started reporting this piece, broken through. And in some sense, I'm incredibly grateful that I followed her, because she seems to have done something extraordinary. There's a whole bunch of theories, Brian, for why Elizabeth Warren is really gaining momentum. And I think that one answer to it is that she's the person who is closest in policy terms to Bernie Sanders. And so for a lot of people who are big Bernie fans, but either think he's too old or too polarizing, or they can't have their hearts broken again, she's a viable alternative. There are an awful lot of people out there saying, look, I love Bernie, but I could live with Warren. And I think she's peeling some of them off. I think that the women that I interviewed for my piece are just in love with her. And I say that because some of them are reluctant to fall in love again, especially with the woman, but they are really on fire over her. And I think that the other thing I noted is that she's really willing to say, she was one of the first people willing to say, I think it's time for impeachment inquiry. She's, putting out a plan a week. They're detailed, very, very, very clear and coherent plans. And I think that for a nation that is, you know, as we were just saying, sort of numb to all the sound and the fury and the madness, there's something really deeply appreciated about a person who's just kind of putting her head down and trudging through it and getting it done. And the folks I talk to just adore her.
Jane in Troy, Montana. You're on WNYC with Dahlia Lithwick from Slate. Hi, Jane.
Good morning, Brian. I have worked in political organizing, and in that job, I regularly ran across federal employees who were concerned about hatch violations. And so I'm wondering, in light of the Kellyanne Conway story, how regularly and how uniformly is the Hatch Act enforced?
If you happen to know that about how the Hatch Act is enforced, I'm just curious, Jane, why don't you put a little more meat on those bones? You say you've run across in political organizing workers who are concerned about Hatch violations. Do you mean the Kellyanne Conway story in particular, or has this come up in other ways too?
This has come up in other ways. You know, I would be calling folks, encouraging them to get involved for this political campaign, and they would say that they were nervous about spending even their off time on political organizing for fear that it would violate the Hatch, and they were concerned about losing their jobs because of that.
Right. Interesting. And I can say from our own experience, Dahlia, you've probably had a similar experience. When we call elected officials to get a comment on anything that might be campaign related, let's say they're running for re-election, and we may have a number of questions for them, and some are policy oriented and some are a little more campaign oriented, the press secretaries are usually meticulous about saying we can't answer any questions having to do with the re-election or whatever the campaign is. You'll have to contact the campaign for that. If the Trump administration, through Kellyanne Conway, mixing business and campaigning, is just thumbing their collective noses at that, that's new.
I think that's right. And I think that, you know, how is it enforced? It's really not. I mean, here, the OSC report says if this were, if she answered to anyone but the president directly, there could be sanctions. They said we're not in a position to sanction her, but the president should. And then they pretty explicitly say, I mean, here's the report summarizing. She regularly participates in official media interviews in her capacity as a White House spokesperson, and beginning in February 2019, during those appearances, she began to engage in a pattern of partisan attacks on Democratic Party candidates, Cory Booker, Elizabeth Warren, Biden, and it essentially says that she, you know, there is, I agree, the line is murky, but she absolutely crossed the line. She was warned. She did it again and again and again. And one other thing that's just interesting is that the White House defense that they have mounted is they're saying that her First Amendment rights are violated by the Hatch Act. They're quite literally claiming that she's allowed to say whatever she wants and that the Hatch Act, I guess, is unconstitutional. We know from Supreme Court precedent that's not true. We know that constraints on government workers' speech are constitutional in all sorts of contexts, but literally they've busted out the old she can say what she wants to say because free speech argument, and that's new as well.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio, where we have a few minutes left with Slate legal affairs writer Dahlia Lithwick, who also hosts their Amicus podcast. I want to ask you about, through your legal affairs lens, the Sarah Huckabee Sanders story, which is that she's leaving as White House press secretary. And what people may know, unless they've read the 448 pages of the Mueller report, is that she's documented in the report as having lied to the American people about whether many FBI agents had lost faith in Jim Comey when she was trying to defend Trump's firing of Comey under questionable circumstances. The Mueller report says Sanders told Mueller that she had a, quote, slip of the tongue when she told reporters that, quote, countless members of the FBI had lost faith in Comey. But her slip of the tongue defense seems like a lie in and of itself, because Mueller also writes that Huckabee Sanders, quote, recalled that her statement in a separate press interview that rank and file FBI agents had lost confidence in Comey was a comment she made in the heat of the moment that was not founded on anything, unquote. In other words, Mueller documents her lying about Comey's standing among rank and file agents twice, including lying about her lie. Because if you state the same falsehood two times, it's by definition not a slip of the tongue, as she claimed it right. was. It's something you said on purpose. So I guess my question is twofold. Do you think being discredited like this has anything to do with why she's leaving? And does it have any legal implications, either for her or as the president continues to be under scrutiny by Congress?
I don't think that she feels a lick of heat, Brian, for being caught out in a lie in the Mueller report or in a lie sandwich, as you point out, you know, lying about lying. I think that she, for reasons I don't fully understand, really felt it was her job to amplify and to double down on whatever the president wanted to hear. And, you know, that's a pattern that we saw with Sean Spicer, right, making claims about inaugural crowds. This seems to be the job, is you tell the lie that the president wants you to tell. And, you know, interestingly, in the Mueller report, that we get pushback when people like Don McGahn, White House counsel, don't want to, you know, write a note to file with a lie in it. But overwhelmingly, I think the sad story of this administration is that people don't leave because they're embarrassed about being caught lying for the president. They leave because they're done. They're ready for another thing. And I think in Sarah Huckabee Sanders' case, A, she wants to run for governor, I think, and B, she'll get a very lucrative job somewhere in the media. So I don't think she's suffering. I think there, you know, there is this underlying question that is left unanswered in the Mueller report. If you think about the very beginning, he talks about the destruction of evidence, that they couldn't find all the things they were looking for because people were erasing messages. So there's a lot of underlying misconduct, not just her lies, but multiple actions taken to almost obstruct the obstruction. And there is a real question. I think you're asking a really the hard question, which is, will there be consequences if Robert Mueller knows that people were destroying evidence or instructing one another not to tell the truth? And I don't think we know that yet. I think we're going to know a lot more about whether there will be legal consequences for those folks if we ever see the completely unredacted report.
Dahlia Lithwick's latest article on Slate is "The Nepotism Might Finally Be Too Much to Ignore." Dahlia, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.